The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Steve Caulfield, and I'm a history education major at the University of Delaware, and I'm also a huge Reacher and Free Library fan. Well, so naturally, tonight I'm absolutely thrilled to introduce Lee Child. You know, I know from the start of the series of Killing Floor, I would pick them up and I wouldn't be able to put them down. I would read straight through the night. And then thankfully, my grandmother working here at the Free Library, I was able to read the series in quick succession, as they have a very large selection of mystery novels here at Parkway Central and throughout the rest of their branches. In The Affair, the 16th and newest addition to the Reacher series, Child travels back in time the 6 months before Killing Floor takes place, so we get the opportunity to get a deeper understanding of how Reacher came to be the character who he is today and why he left the Army, which has been his family and his home for so many years. After reading The Affair, Jerry Harkavy of the Associated Press writes, "As with all Reacher books, the writing is spare and crisp, with the hero's dialogue comprised in a style which Hemingway would approve. It is truly a pleasure to have such a talented author here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lee Child."
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Steve, for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for the invitation. It's fantastic to be in this institution. I mean, you probably all take it for granted, but these great urban libraries are, just some of the greatest places in the world. I've been to a lot of them, but mostly as a consumer of books and information and so on, and I certainly have read biographies and autobiographies of a lot of great men and women who are solely dependent on libraries like this to really for their whole education and their whole lives. And I'm kind of one of them, although the library that I went to was by no means as grand as this. I grew up in Birmingham, England, and my library was in what we called a Nissen hut, which you guys would call a Quonset hut. It was on a bombed-out lot behind a wrecked church, and it had not all that many books. And by the time I was about nine, I'd read them all, children's section and adult section. And then my mother, who no doubt regarded it as just a normal part of mothering, she then got me a library card for the municipality that was across the canal from where we lived, which was a larger library. It was about three or four times the size. And that really was the place I got my education, although I did go to a school that was founded in 1552. But it was a very prestigious British high school, but it was modeled on the Oxford University syllabus. And at that time, 1965, I started at that school. And at that time, Oxford University regarded anything after 1485 as dangerously modern. Modern history ended in 1485, according to Oxford. Anything after 1485 was so recent and so current, it was practically journalism. So none of that stuff was taught, so I relied on the library. I got an education, and my life took various twists and turns, and I eventually ended up a writer through no fault of my own. I was a television director, really, and I was really interested in entertainment. I was in the theater first, then television. And then I got fired from that job at the age of 39, almost 40. So it was a question of what to do next. And, you know, that was a major problem. Ideally, I would like to retire at that point. But even I realized that 40 was too young to retire. So, I knew I had to do something else. I was fed up with the corporate situation, so I wanted to get out of that. And I remember sitting down and thinking, looking at my fast dwindling savings, which were actually not really savings at all. I had about 7 months living money. I could make seven more mortgage payments. before I hit the street, and I remember thinking, all right, what can I do? And I thought, you know what, I'll write a book. I've read some, how hard can it be? And so I sat down and wrote Killing Floor and sent it to an agent, and the agent got it sold 6 weeks before my money ran out. So it was a very happy start to the whole thing, and I remember thinking at the time, that's great, you know, I can make, it was a two-book contract, and I thought, that's fantastic. That's 2 years before I have to get a job. And those 2 years have now turned into 16, and that is down to you, and I thank you very much for it. Because along the way, I'm not especially academic. I'm not especially intellectual. What you got to do is, I have an English accent, which I know that counts as a sort of automatic 20 points on my IQ. I understand that, and believe me, I exploit it ruthlessly. So what you need to do is discount me by 20 IQ points, and yes, I really am that dumb. But I've learned a couple of things along the way. One is that a book is a two-way street, is a transaction. First it is written, then it is read, then it exists. In other words, the reader creates the book as much as the writer does. And secondly, I learned that there are no such things as good books. There are merely books with good readers. And I'm lucky enough to have the best readers of all. So this 16-book success story that has been Reacher is down to you as much as it's down to me, which means that you are entitled to ask me anything you want to know about Reacher, the books, past books, future books, movies, whatever you want to know. Other people's books we could talk about. I've got to know a lot of writers. They're not here tonight. We can talk about them. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to talk for a little bit about The Affair, the new book, but then as soon as I run out of things to say, I'm going to invite questions, and I find that that is the best way to do one of these evenings because you've done me the enormous compliment of showing up, and it would be a shame if, you know, you're giving up your time. There are better things to do. You could be eating. You could be watching the New York Yankees. Okay. All right, like that, is it? We shall see. We shall see. Well, at least, you know, quite often I say you could be watching what passes for baseball in your town, but I didn't say that. I hope we all meet again in about 4 weeks, okay? So yeah, you could be doing better things, but you're here, and it would be a shame if you had to go home. If you have burning issues and you want to raise, it would be a shame if you had to go home without raising them. So all questions will be invited. And there are no dumb questions. Well, you know, there are one or two dumb questions, but most questions are fine. So we'll get to that in a moment, but first The Affair, which is the 16th book. And as you know, the series has grown and grown in readership with each installment, which means that the promotion hoopla has grown and grown as well, and that means that typically, you know, there's a lot of interviews to do, and, you know, radio, TV, print journalism. And there tends to be a little bit of a herd mentality amongst journalists that they all come up independently with the same question. And the question that they've all come up with this time is, why now? Why now did I decide to go back in time for this prequel story and tell that, you know, the history of Reacher's last case, the thing that shook him loose from the army. Why now? And there's a polite PR answer to that question that I've been giving the journalists, and then there's also the truth. And the polite answer is that, you know, I figured for 15 books so far, you've been reading about Reacher, you've grown fond of him. And there is one issue, that he's clearly comfortable with the military, he was clearly happy in the military, he clearly respects the military and holds nothing against it, yet he left, apparently voluntarily. Why did he do that? People have always wanted to know that, and frankly, so have I. I've always wanted to know that. And I thought, now is the right time to answer that question. So this is, it's a prequel. It's set in 1997. It is Reacher's last case in uniform. It's time to answer that question. And it was a fun challenge for me to do because instead of Reacher getting a little older and wiser with each book, I had to jump way back and make him not exactly younger and dumber, but, you know, a more dynamic, slightly more naive, slightly more energetic character. In other words, just adjust his age. He's 36 in this book. Then that was a challenge to do writing-wise. And it was also a challenge in the sense of imagining, remembering, really, what the world was like in 97. I mean, the world was very different then, actually. We've lived those years day by day without really noticing how things have changed. And, of course, after 2001, things did change quite radically. And thinking back to 97 is quite refreshing. Remember what it was like? You could get on a plane wearing your clothes, you know, remember that? And all that kind of thing. You could. I used to do book signings in the Pentagon back then. Now you can't get in there and all that kind of thing. So it was about recreating that slightly forgotten world, making Reacher younger, telling that story. So that's the polite journalistic answer, and here's the truth. The truth is this, that if you think back a couple of books to 61 Hours, did anybody read 61 Hours? Remember it? Thank you. What happened in 61 Hours was that he was trapped in South Dakota in this snowbound town with a very small group of characters. And the main other character in the book was an older woman, a librarian, a very dignified and noble old lady. And Reacher got on really well with her. I thought that was a really good relationship. I loved that character very much, and I was very sorry that I had to kill her. She was, and it was a very strong dynamic, I think, between the two of them, except that it was not a romantic dynamic. You know, there was no sex there. But the love interest, such as it was in that book, came from phone calls that he made. He made phone calls back to his old unit in Virginia, and he was speaking to the woman who had taken over his job, or, you know, it was his successor many times removed. And he became obsessed with her voice, and he was imagining how beautiful she must be, and so he was thinking, all right, I'm heading straight to Virginia now to meet her. So at the end of 61 Hours, he's on his way to Virginia, but then we run into the events of Worth Dying For, which was the next book, where he's trying to get through Nebraska so he can turn east and head for Virginia, but he gets hung up in Nebraska because there's a problem. He's there for a couple of days, but because in his head he's got this beautiful woman in his mind, he does not have sex with anybody in Nebraska either, because that would feel kind of disloyal or unfaithful to this woman in Virginia. And so when it came time to write this year's book, I thought, you know what, we cannot go three books we just cannot go three books without him getting laid. I could not do that. But, of course, unless he actually gets to Virginia this time, you know, it would be, like, unfaithful again, wouldn't it? So, and I thought, I'm not ready for him to get to Virginia yet, because I don't really know what I'm going to do with them when I get him there. So I'm not ready for that story, so what can I do? And I thought, I don't know, I'll do a prequel, because then we can go way back in time, and then he can have a relationship with somebody without appearing to be unfaithful in the current day. And so that was my decision, and I thought, because I'm a person who hates moderation, I don't like to do anything by halves, I thought, all right, well, if we're going to have sex in that book, then let's really have some. You know? Let's totally go for it. And so this book is a bit of a departure. You know, you could call it romantic fiction, if you like. There is a significant amount of carnal relationship in this book. Which is, again, a huge challenge writing-wise, because there is nothing in the world harder to write than sex scenes. You know, they're terribly difficult, and they can fail spectacularly. In fact, in Britain, where I come from, there is an actual literary award called the Bad Sex Award. Like any other award, it has a shortlist, and it has a prize, and all that kind of stuff, and because it is so difficult to do. But you'll have to read the book and see what you think. Do I deserve that award, or do I escape it? You know. And obviously I'm hoping that I escape it. And I think possibly I do, because I found a kind of thing to to help me out with the sex scenes. There's a thing going on that actually propels them in a way that occurred to me very late in the process. I was sitting there at my computer just panicking completely and trying to dredge up memories, you know, because they say write what you know. And and I've been married a very long time. And so I was thinking, so what happens now? And then this sudden thing popped into my head. I know how to do it. And from that point on, it became quite easy and quite fun. So I think it came out all right. And, you know, I think the book is certainly getting decent reviews. You know, a lot of people like it. And in fact, it's written in the first person, in which some of my books are, and in fact, most of them aren't, but some of them are. But it's a slightly different first person voice in that it's not a contemporaneous narration. It's really a recollection. You get the sense that Reacher is looking back at these events at a significant remove, many years later, possibly. It could be from today, looking back 14 years. It could be even longer. You know, it's a definite reminiscence in the voice. And, you know, he points out several times. He says, this was 1997, remember, about various things. So it's a different kind of first-person voice. And in fact, a British newspaper, quite a highbrow broadsheet paper over there, said that the voice in it is kind of Proustian, which, if I had the slightest idea what that meant, I might be quite flattered, or not, possibly. And then it said the point of view manipulation was like Flaubert. And again, if I knew who Flaubert was, again, I might be quite flattered or not. Because I don't know any of that stuff. Like I said, I'm not a theorist. I'm not a literary critic. I just close my eyes and hope for the best, see what comes out. And as long as it keeps me satisfied, that's all you can do, really. I mean, I think as a writer, if you start worrying about what the readers are going to think, then you're lost, because you can't really write for anybody except yourself. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that the kind of thing that amuses me and I like is shared by a lot of people. And that's the fundamental thing about luck in writing. People say you've got to be lucky to be a writer. And you do, absolutely, but not in the sense that you're sitting on a plane and the person in the seat next to you knows a literary agent, or, you know, you're at a cocktail party and somebody's sister-in-law is a publisher. Not that kind of luck. Those are shortcuts. That's not really the same thing as luck. The luck is this, that you, if you've got the facility to write, to get down on the paper exactly what is in your head, that's what writing is. It's transferring the images and feelings and stories in your head, getting it down accurately on paper. If you can do that, then you're a writer. But the luck is what is in your head of any interest to anybody? That's the simple thing. And for very many people, yes, it is, but only a few people. You know, we're not all that different from one another, so that really all of us would find 1,000 or 10,000 people that will share our views and opinions and enjoyments. But it's lucky if you find 100,000 people that do, and it's even more lucky if you find 1,000,000 people that do. That's where the luck is, and I've been very lucky that what is in my head is shared by an awful lot of people, and as I say, I'm eternally grateful for that. So does anybody at this point have any initial questions? And don't forget, there's a guy back there. There's people with microphones, because then everybody can hear the question. And
yes, if you raise your hand, we will get a microphone to you as quickly as possible. So the gentleman all the way in back there. Okay. No, just yell it out.
I'll yell it out. What do you think of Tom Cruise?
What do I think of Tom Cruise playing Reacher in the movie? Well, the problem is if I give you the first half of the answer, it kind of implies an attitude on my part that it should not necessarily imply. Okay, so I will tell you the first part of the answer, but do not infer anything from it in any positive or negative way. The I have, and again, I'm serious, do not infer anything from this, but these are the facts that I had absolutely no say in it whatsoever. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two is I am contractually obliged not to badmouth the movie. But do not read, I'm not trying to give you a coded message there. I'm really not trying to give you a coded message because I completely and totally support the casting of Tom Cruise. Because it is, you know, there are a thousand things that can go right or wrong with the movie. And none of those thousand is the physical resemblance between the actor and the character. You know, that just is not on anybody's radar. It's not going to make the slightest bit of difference. What matters is the script, the feel on the screen, the intangible stuff. You know, Reach is a big, tough guy, absolutely. But that is, in the books, absolutely portrayed by the fact that he's gigantic. But you can portray that in different ways on the screen, because on the screen, everybody is an actor. In the book, Reach is tough, and the other people are therefore scared, okay? In the movie, the lead character looks, you know, pretends, acts scary, and the other actors act scared because they're actors. You know, they control both ends of the deal in the movie. And so how it looks on the screen is not going to be any kind of a problem. I completely understand that everybody is going to be in exactly the same boat that I was in, which is that I'm thinking, what? And I completely understand that. But like I said, before I was a writer, I was in TV. And I've done a related business. And in fact, the TV company I worked for had a movie arm, and we made some movies, and in fact, the first movie we ever made won 2 Oscars. So, you know, I've done this before, and I've seen how this works. And what happens is, ironically, to faithfully transfer the feeling of the page to the screen, you have to change everything. And so people that are very, very familiar with the books are going to be in exactly the same position that I was about 10 days ago. 10 days ago, I went to the set to meet with them all, the cast, the crew, the production people, the investors. We had this big thing. And the center part of that is called a read-through, where it's a big, large meeting room where you sit around this huge square table, and the script is there, and the actors read it through. And it's the very first introduction of the movie to everybody. You know, everybody's meeting for the first time. The cameramen are there. The cinematographer is there. The props people are there. Everybody's getting to grips with this movie, and it's really the way of introducing it. And it feels very, very much like the first jolt of electricity going into Frankenstein's monster. You have this real sense it's waking up, it's coming alive. You know, still a lot more to be done, but this is the very first sign that it's coming alive. So I saw this read-through, and I was in a situation that I expect you will be, should you choose to go to the movie, which is that for the first 5 minutes, I'm thinking, I'm just weirded out completely. I mean, just this is so weird. But what happens then is the first 5 minutes, all right, yeah, I completely understand. But the test of this movie is going to be, what happens for the next 95 minutes? Does it suck you in? Do you buy it? Do you forget about your worries? Do you enjoy the rest of the movie? And I did. You know, the first 5 minutes were strange, and then I just got sucked in. And it's a great script. It's going to be a great movie. And the Tom Cruise thing means that it's going to be, it has an enormous budget. It's going to have a gigantic promotion budget. It'll open everywhere in every country of the world. And like I said before, I don't like things done in moderation. I did not want a little kind of independent movie with some unknown people that would play in 3 or 4 art cinemas. If I'm going to have a movie, I want a movie star in it. And this guy is obviously a movie star. He's a very talented actor, which is what you don't see necessarily because of all that stuff, you know, that superstar hoopla, the tabloid stuff, the odd things that he's done, you don't necessarily focus on the fact that technically he's a very good actor. And I'm speaking as somebody who has always worked with actors. I've worked with actors all my life. I go back so far, in fact, that the first time I worked with Laurence Olivier, he was still in his 60s. I know actors very well, and he is a talented actor. He will do the job. And my guess is that probably not all of you will go. You won't want to see it. But those of you that do, you will feel strange for 5 minutes, and then I think you'll be fine. I really think it will be like that. I sincerely hope so anyway. The other thing to say about it is we haven't seen it yet. Let's judge it after it's made, not before it's made. That would seem to be the most rational way to do it, and I'm a very honest and straightforward guy. If it's shit, I'll say so. We can meet here in a couple of years, and we can, having seen it, we can say what we thought of it.
All right, here's to those 2 years. Sir, right in front here.
Over time, I guess I read practically everything that Robert P. Parker wrote specific to Spencer. I feel I know who he is, and I can almost predict, if there were to be a next novel, how he should behave. So I guess my question to you is, who as a human being is Reacher? Who is he?
Who as a human being is Reacher? Who is he? Well, I think, in the sense that you could predict what Spencer was going to do, you can predict what Reacher's going to do. I mean, Reacher is a guy who is phobic about coming to rest. So he will always keep on moving. He will go from place to place on a random and arbitrary basis. He'll wind up somewhere, and, of course, 360 days of the year, nothing will happen to him. He will just eat at the diner, drink a cup of coffee, get on a bus, and move on. But amazingly enough, once a year, which is a reasonable odds. It would happen to any of us. I tell you, if you were on the road for 365 days a year, going from place to place, most of them would be completely uneventful, but you would run into trouble once in a while. And so he will run into trouble, it is possible to say what he will do. He will not back down. He will not be intimidated. He will discern who is right and who is wrong. He will discern what is just and what is unjust. And then he will absolutely take the law into his own hands and put it right, even to the extent... we get bizarre reactions to some of the books because somebody once said... Somebody said about Worth Dying For that it wasn't violent enough. And I'm thinking, really? He burned people to death, ran them over with trucks, broke their arms, shot them in the head. That's what Reacher will do to the bad guys. And then he'll get on the bus and move on. So I think that's who he is as a person. He is a force for what is fair and what is right. And I think that explains his appeal, essentially, because on the one hand, yes, he's described as a specific human character with needs and tastes, and he gets hungry, he gets thirsty, all that kind of thing. But on another level, he's a metaphor. He supplies what we all want, which is fairness and justice. He consoles us because real life is not like that. Real life is most unsatisfactory most of the time. If somebody steals your car in real life, you're not going to get it back. They'll never catch the guys. That's the end of it. But in this type of fiction, you bet they find the guys. Reacher finds the guys. You get your car back and Reacher takes care of the guys. And that is very consoling. It makes you feel happy and satisfied, and it gives you the clarity that real life does not give you. So in that sense, he's a real person, but he's also a metaphor for what we want in the back of our minds. That's what I think. I mean, the entire success of the Reacher series is based on the fact that everybody, most people are too civilized to admit it in public, but I admit it. It's based on the fact that everybody has a long list of people they would cheerfully shoot in the head.
Thank you. but not in a library. Gentleman in red.
First of all, thank you. I've either read or listened on audiobooks, so everything. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the process of creating the audiobook version. What role do you play? Do you have anything to do with it?
The audiobook is, they do two versions of the audiobook. One is called abridged and one is unabridged. In other words, an edited version that is much shorter and then the full thing. And I have really only one involvement, which is that they send me the abridged script. They have an abridger, which is a particular type of editor. That they do it for audiobooks. Reader's Digest also does it for what they call their condensed books. And along with translators, in my opinion, abridgers are the unsung heroes of this business. Nobody ever talks about them. They never get mentioned. They probably don't get paid very much, but they do a superb job. You know, they take a 120,000-word book and they boil it down to 30 or 35,000 words, and it's all there, and it's done in such a way that you think, you know, you really start to think that the rest of it was superfluous because, they've come up with such a great version. So they send me that script and I'm supposed to okay it. And I never do. I pretend to have read it because I delay answering the email for a day or two and then I just write back and say, yes, that's fine, because I know it will be. So that's really the only involvement I have other than the first 10 of the books were done by a company called Brilliance Audio, who had a reader called Dick Hill under contract, who I thought was really, really good. And I know for a lot of people, he is the voice of Reacher. I mean, he is Jack Reacher for a lot of people. And then as a kind of contractual issue, I had to move the audiobooks from Brilliance to Random House Audio. And I said that Dick Hill had to keep on reading them. I wouldn't do it unless Dick was the reader, and so he still is. But apart from that, I don't really have much involvement at all. I hang out with Dick occasionally. You know, every time a script goes into, he reads the script ready to go in the studio and do it, and he always emails me about pronunciation or what does this mean or that mean, and so we have a bit of a correspondence. And once or twice we've done events together where we sign CDs together. Him as the narrator and me as the writer. And he's a really nice guy and does a great job. For me personally, I don't love audiobooks because, I don't have a commute in that sense that I don't. When I go to work, I live on the 25th floor and my office is on the 7th floor. So I commute 18 floors in the elevator and it doesn't give me a lot of time for listening to the audiobook. So I've never really got into them in the way that other people have, but I know that other people love them. I mean, it's a really main road into any series these days. Anecdotally, this promotion tour, loads and loads of people have said they love Dick Hill and he does such a great job. And in fact, that reminds me, I must email him and tell him that because, again, these people, he's probably stuck in the studio right now recording somebody else's book and he should know how much you like him.
More questions. On our left, gentleman in the black.
On the left.
Hi. Question about where did Reacher come from? When, before you wrote The Killing Floor, was this character sort of in your ruminating around in there for months and months and months or years and years and years, or did you just sort of pull him out of the air and you said you had 7 months to write this,
Yeah, I mean, I had a very short time to write the book, and I was also very aware of, having been in a parallel business for a long time, I was very aware that you cannot overthink it or overplan it. I think if you see, and I was in a desperate situation. I was out of work. This had to succeed. It was not a question of this is kind of something I would kind of like to do. It wasn't something I was kind of interested in. This had to work. But I was, the contradictory aspect to that is that the more desperate it becomes, the less you can afford to think about it. Because if you start to overthink a thing, if you start to say to yourself, well, this has got to work, and therefore I need people in America to buy it, and I need people in Britain to buy it, and I need women aged 45 to 54, there are big book market segment, and I need younger men, and I need this, and I need that. If you start to over-specify it like that in your head, then you end up with a completely wooden character with all the life beaten out of him. He's to some extent politically correct. He's ticking too many boxes. He's kind of laundry list of virtues that you imagine people are going to respond to. And I was very aware of that. The only way to do it is to completely close your eyes, empty your head, and just write completely from the gut and see what comes out. And, of course, what came out was Reacher. But looking back on it, of course, you can then analyze it. And after two or three books, I started to think, well, where did he come from? You know, I was asking myself the same question that you're asking. And clearly, where he came from was decades and decades of reading. Because, generally speaking, I mean, I think literally the only preparation for being a writer is to be a reader. You've got to have read and read and read thousands and thousands and thousands of books. And you reach a point where you feel that you can then start doing it. And so I'd read all those books, and, you know, with this part of them at school, part of them at college, and this huge broad spread of stuff, fiction, nonfiction, history, ancient stuff, modern stuff. And you suddenly realize that there is a kind of universal character. In fact, there are several universal characters, but one of them very much is the mysterious stranger, the noble loner, who shows up at the crucial time, performs some vital service, and then rides off into the sunset. That character has been around for literally thousands of years and tends to pop up in one genre representation or another every 50 or 100 years. And you can stretch that, you can trace it back. I mean, obviously the Westerns, you know, that character, Chain, the man with no name, any Zane Grey hero, that was very much the center of Western storytelling in America. But it was not invented there. That was an adaptation, pretty much lock, stock, and barrel, of a much earlier myth from Europe, from the medieval period. Middle Ages in Europe had the identical character. Instead of riding in off the range with his Winchester rifle, the medieval version would ride out of the forest with a lance, exactly the same character, perform the vital service, and then ride off into the sunset. You trace it back a little further, it's there in the Scandinavian sagas. Further than that, it's in the Anglo-Saxon poems. You could even argue that it's a religious type of myth. It's a savior myth, the mysterious character who shows up and is central to people's lives. So this is a character that has always existed, and I guess I realized what I'd done is just tapped into that, written a version of that character. Specifically, I think it was a character that appealed to me because it had been corrupted and polluted somewhat in recent genre fiction, in as much as these heroes were, I think, out of the delusion that it makes them interesting, a lot of writers were making them very damaged and dysfunctional. They were, one after the other, they were alcoholics or recovering alcoholics or divorced recovering alcoholics. Or divorced recovering alcoholics who were so traumatized by a mistake that they had to go and live on their own in the woods. And, you know, they were carrying bullets, either literal or metaphorical, lodged next to their heart. And they were sort of dragging themselves miserably from one page to the next. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to short-circuit that and go back to an older form of hero that was uncomplicated. And, you know, Reacher certainly is. Reacher is a very simple man. Or at least he thinks he's a very simple man. He thinks there's nothing unusual about him. I didn't want a navel-gazing, damaged person. And so that, I think, automatically took me back and fed me into that much more ancient stream. So, you know, I don't like to think about it too much because, to paraphrase Yogi Berra, I can't write and think at the same time. But, you know, clearly that's where the character comes from, I think.
Back on our right, about halfway. Mary, on your left, gentleman with his hand up.
First of all, this is a great opportunity. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us. I'm a huge fan of your books. I feel so empty at the end of the books because there's not another one to read. So I'm just delighted. But I've always been amazed that since you grew up in England, the intricate detail you give to geography, how you portray each of these cities and towns. Do you actually go to these places, or are these all something you envision Always been intrigued by that.
Yeah, I mean, most of them I've been to in terms of the locations, not really specifically in order to write about them. It happens the other way around. What happens is typically I will be somewhere for work or for fun or for vacation or whatever, and it will create some kind of subliminal impression, and then it could be years later I'm thinking about writing the next book, and I'm starting to think, you know, what mood do I want for it? What feel do I want for it? And the memories of some particular place will pop up, and I'll think, yeah, that's the perfect location for it. So I kind of do the research in reverse. I mine the memory banks, the things that I've seen or places that I've been. And, of course, some of the places are made up. You know, they're fictional towns based on a kind of amalgam or composite of various different places. And I find it, yeah, I do find it endlessly fascinating. The geography and the you know, the populations and the diversity and the places in America, and I think inevitably, because, you know, coming from Europe, it is such a change. You know, this is a vast, gigantic continent with staggering diversity of different types of people, different types of places, and when you are coming in as a newcomer with fresh eyes, you do notice everything. Everything is important. It's kind of everything is equally important. You notice everything. You're not making prejudgments about what is important, what isn't important. Everything is fresh and new. And people assume that it's somehow harder to write about America as a non-American or as an immigrant. And I would argue the exact reverse. It's easier, much easier. You know, I certainly travel much more than most people do. I see more of the country. And like I said, it's all fresh to me. It's all new, and therefore I'm seeing the things that you are just mentally glossing over, that you're so accustomed to that you no longer take notice of. And so I think in general it's far easier for me to notice the details, the telling facts, the telling images. That stuff I think is much more natural for an incomer than somebody who's lived here. You know, it sounds counterintuitive, but I'm sure it's true.
Lady right here on the 1, 2, 3, 4th row here. The mic is coming to you. And do we have somebody on this side also? Lady 1, 2, 3 in the front row here.
This lady here?
Yeah, right up here. We'll go to you next.
I've read all of the all of your books, but I'm also a writer. So I just had a question for you about your writing process. Do you outline? Do you just kind of go with it? Do you reach rough spots, and how do you get through those?
Well, thanks for reading all the books, and good luck on being a writer. It's a wonderful life. It really is. I don't outline. I don't plan in any way at all, because I feel like, to me, the essential part of writing this kind of book is I love I want to be just as excited about writing the next scene as you are about reading it. Okay, you reach the end of a chapter, you are desperate to know what happens in the next chapter, and that's how I want to feel as a writer. I don't want to already know what happens in the next chapter. I want that to be unknown to me, so I don't make an outline. And I feel that if I outlined the thing, then I've already told myself the story. It's over for me at that point. I lose interest in it. I know what happens, and if I then have to write it out, expand that outline into a novel-length piece, I'm going to be bored doing it, and I feel like that boredom would show through. So I deliberately don't want to know what happens next, and I genuinely have no idea what happens next. I really don't know what happens paragraph to paragraph, which is kind of like real life. You don't know what's going to happen next. I just have an idea where to start, and so I write the first scene, and then from that point on, it's like a stone just rolling down the hill. I've got no idea where it's going to go. And, you know, that's literally true, and it always amuses me when people say, I figured out who did it by page 50. I'm like, you did? I didn't know. I had no idea who did it by page 50. So that's the process. It's all improvised, all made up as I go along. But having said that, you know, that is against the background of having read tens of thousands of books and having done, you know, my TV career extended to 40,000 hours of popular entertainment. So the sort of DNA level structure of storytelling, I think, is absolutely there. So I'm kind of surfing on a whole lot of hidden background, I honestly think. I mean, I don't think, I mean, I'm not some sort of idiot savant who just could make up an entire novel out of the blue. I think it is surfing on a lot of previous experience in this type of thing. So, and, you know, I'm not necessarily recommending you do it my way either, because every writer works different ways. I was just saying before, if you ask 10 writers how they do it, you're going to get 12 answers. And some people outline extensively. You know, Jeffrey Deaver, who's a friend of mine, he will do a 200-page outline for a 500-page novel. You know, that's a level of obsessive work that I couldn't even contemplate, but he has to do it that way. Other people do it my way. Some people do it half and half. The most common metaphor that we ever use is that it's like driving a car at night. You've got to drive from, say, Philly to New York at night, and you know you're going to start in Philly, you know you're going to get to New York, but along the way you can see no further than your headlight beams. And that's a bit like how it is. You know, typically I can see a short way ahead and I have a very vague sensation of what might be coming next, but I'll just see how it turns out.
Lady in the front row.
Do you have any plans to continue the story of Reacher as a young boy?
Well, I don't know about that, really. I mean, the Reacher as a Young Boy thing, Second Son, was an electronic short story only, and it was really a bit of a marketing experiment. We just thought, you know, what would happen, and we were also aware that this book, The Affair, it's a prequel, and therefore Reacher's brother is still alive, and Reacher makes a couple of attempts to call his brother. And it was felt by the publisher that for people that weren't intimately familiar with the whole series, so let's say they'd read three or four of the later books in a rather casual way, they would be puzzled. They would be like, what's this brother? I didn't know he had a brother. And so the idea was we would do the short story that concentrated a little bit on the family to explain the brother thing in advance. And it would also just test out this new e-market and all that kind of thing. And I certainly enjoyed writing the short story, but it's not part of any overarching strategy that I have. You know, if somebody wants another short story next year in the same kind of situation ahead of the publication, and they say, yeah, you know, Reacher was 13 in that story, let's make him 15 in the next story, then, yeah, I would certainly do it. But I feel like maybe one childhood story is enough. Although maybe I could go back even further, you know. Reacher in kindergarten or Reacher's mother while pregnant, you know, something like that.
A few more. A gentleman in the fourth row here, right in the fourth row.
Lee, I know you said a few minutes ago that you don't really outline the books, think that much ahead. And I also know that at the beginning of the presentation, when you were starting to talk about The Affair, you said that you yourself wanted to know Reacher's backstory, his history, that it was going to be fun for you to do that. But I remember several years ago when you were doing one of these appearances on behalf of one of the earlier books, and I'm sorry I don't remember the title, but it was a book that also took place in Reacher's past when he was still a military cop. And you said during the appearance that I saw that you envisioned that sometime down the line you were going to write this book, that you were going to tell the story. And I think you knew at that time that a lot of people would really like to know that story. So I guess I have two questions. One, did you really not have any idea at when you went into this what that story was actually going to be, or had you been thinking about it? And also, did you feel a special amount of pressure going into this one, anticipating that a lot of people had been looking forward to knowing this particular story for a long time?
Well, to answer them in reverse order, I always do and don't feel any pressure. I mean, you can't really afford to think about the pressure because, you know, it's awesome at this point. Because I feel very strongly inside that when I started out, as I said, I was just trying to make a living. And then, you know, that goal is achieved. And then you've got to find or, you know, the financial necessity is therefore replaced by something else. And what it was replaced by to me is much more of an emotional contract with the reader. You know, I'm intensely aware that the readers are really enjoying this. They want another one next year, and they do not want to be disappointed. And, you know, that is awesome pressure. You know, it's got to the point where I would rather be broke and lose my house than disappoint the reader, because you have been so nice and so supportive. And like I said at the beginning, I'm not kidding, you have created this just as much as I have. And therefore, the pressure to not let you down next year is immense. And therefore, the only real way to deal with immense pressure is ignore it. And so in a sense, I don't feel any pressure because it's too big. I just have to put it on one side and suit myself. So did I think I would? Yeah, I remember that book was called The Enemy, and I remember promoting it and saying people have, you know, wanted a prequel, but this actually isn't the one that they wanted because he's still in the army at the end of it, and there was 7 years, theoretically, for what I was going to call the prequel sequel, which is this book. And I suppose it was about refining in my head just very gradually the reasons why he might have left the army. I mean, I started out with Reacher having left, partly obviously it's a dramatic device, it means he's free from structure, but also it was about catharsis for me and for many other people in my situation in the 90s. They were getting fired left and right because of corporate restructuring and stuff like that. And I wanted the catharsis of, here's a guy who was in the army, man and boy, and he's thrown out, and he's perfectly happy with it. He's not worried, he's not upset, he's just getting on with his life. You know, I felt that would be very reassuring to me and to other people. And so as the years went by, I started to nibble away at that, figuring out why did he leave? And I didn't want him to be fired. I didn't want him to be canned in that sense, because that is an admission of failure, really, on Reacher's part, that, you know, if he's in some kind of big trouble and he can't get out of it, then that's actually not the Reacher we know. Reacher would never be fired because he would find a way of beating the rap. So that avenue was closed off. So why did he leave? There had to be something that left him dispirited or dissatisfied with the way things were going. So it was really just a question of trying to work out in my head what was it? What would be enough to make him dispirited and disillusioned enough to turn his back on it? And, you know, it did take quite a while before that crystallized, I think.
So we have time for a couple more questions. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to everybody. This gentleman in the middle, and then the gentleman in the blue, one in from the aisle here.
Hi. This is kind of a question and a comment. We all understand the physicality of Jack Reacher and, you know, what he did to the Nebraska football players and what he's done in all the books, and we like that. But what I hope comes out in the movie is his intellect. He is a keen observer of people. He's a keen observer of situations. He is a planner. He is smarter than anybody in this room, I think, because, you know, a lot of the heroes today have the full faith and backing of the United States government, the CIA, the FBI, DNA, NSA. But Reacher figures it out. He sees which way the wind is blowing. He notices something. He picks up a clue on his own. And it's not just the training that he's got from being an investigator from the Army. It started when he was 5 years old and his brother was 7 years old and they had a fight on the playground and he figured that out. So,
sir, do you have a specific question you'd like to ask?
I hope that comes out in the movie. That's all.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, that's been the movie people have understood that very well from the start. In fact, I remember quite a few years ago, Keanu Reeves wanted to, you know, he was really pushing to play the part, and the producers called me and said, don't worry. You know, their vision is that Reacher is always the smartest guy in the room, and they said, you know, we just don't think that Keanu can do that, so we're going to find a way of stopping him. And so, you know, the movie absolutely will be like that, possibly more like that, because, you know, as has been pointed out obliquely, the physicality may be slightly downplayed in favor of the intellect. So, yeah, there's no question that the movie really understands that. And the read-through that I heard was It's a challenge, actually, because in the book, a lot of it's internal. And so the screenwriter has to find a way of making that external and overt. And I think they've done a really good job. And if you go to the movie, you'll be in no doubt that this is a seriously smart guy. Yeah.
Thank you. First of all, thanks for ruining the 61 hours for those of us who haven't gotten it. Killing off the librarian. It seems that you've reached a select group of writers, serial writers, who get that response that we've heard tonight where somebody said, I feel empty after I've read the last book. And that's kind of a precious place to be. Have you ever thought that maybe once you're gone, Reacher continues and someone else keeps writing, you know?
Well, you know, I'm always thinking, it's like, you know, cab drivers in New York own the medallion. And, you know, when they die, their family can sell the medallion to somebody else. And so I've sort of thought about that, and certainly my daughter's thought about that. But, no, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be, and, you know, I'm not... The really great thing about writing is that every single writer is the best in the world at doing what he or she does. It is such an individual thing that you can, whoever the writer is, you can look at him or her and you can say nobody could write that book better than him or her because it is their product. And so if you extrapolate that about me, nobody could write Reacher like I write Reacher. They just couldn't do it. And that's not a big-headed thing to say. That's just a literal fact. That it's a product of one mind, and another mind would not do it the same. So, and anyway, I don't like to do things by halves. I don't want that kind of compromise, wishy-washy thing going on at the end. The final book in the series is going to be called Die Lonely. And at the end of that book, and it will be a very hard book to plot because we're going to have to create a situation where, without being able to avoid it, Reacher is backed into a corner where he either gives himself up or gives up the person he's protecting. And, of course, Reacher being Reacher would give himself up. So the final scene in that book, he will crawl into some filthy motel bathroom and bleed to death on the floor. And that will be the end of it. And then I'll be living on the beach and you won't be able to find me. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.